wouldn't give it up until you begged. "You're being an ass," I say, and I drop my 7-Up cup between my feet and try to kick it around to look cool, but... "Okay, fine, I'll bite. What are you not telling me?" "It's not my place to say, Quinny," Carly says, reaching forward to do something with my collar. I smack her hand away too hard and feel horrible about it, but she doesn't even register it. Her eyes are now fully fogged over with beer, and so I make like a lighthouse. A lighthouse never sways. "Not your place to say what, Car. I just think you've got this image of your sister as a nun. But she was a fun girl, Q. I just don't think Annabeth was like an all-time saint." "I'm not saying she was a saint, but she was a virgin, and that fact isn't going to change anytime soon." Carly gulps back one more swig of beer and comes up for air. "Yeah, well, you might want to check in with Jeff about that." The fireworks stop. Amir's head appears from the stairwell downstairs, and he goes to call something irrelevant to us, but I don't let him. "What did you just fucking say?" I say. I touch Carly's chin, just like Amir did with me, but God knows I'm not going to kiss her. "What did you just say? Is that some kind of joke?" I knock Carly's cup out of her hands. Now Amir's standing between us like Lou Filippo, the bow-tied ref in Rocky. Guys, what's going on here?" That's when the fireworks start up again, right back to the same colors as the beginning, an entirely repeat show. Amir ducks down and covers his ear, but Carly looks right at me and says, with a frightening kind of clarity that only the truly drunk can summon, "Jeff and I had a bet going. I honestly thought you knew."
"Knew what, Carly?"
"That he and your sister were a thing. We're a thing, we're a thing, we're a thing." "I think that's enough," Amir says, but I am already stepping on both our red cups and crushing them. Then I push past Amir and Carly, and I slip down the wet steps and twist my ankle, but I immediately find the captain, who is hanging out with a couple of sorority girls, and I say, "Amir wants you to take us back to Station Square now." My voice is shaking, and I am, and the captain goes, "He just said he wanted another 45 minutes, kid." But I say louder than the fireworks, "He changed his fucking mind." Chapter 27. Exterior, Station Square, night. Quinn stands in a line of people at the boat dock, waiting to board the shuttle bus back to the South Hills. The fireworks continue to explode overhead, and the crowd around Quinn is admiring the sky, taking selfies, but Quinn is lost in his own world. Cut 2. Interior, shuttle bus to the T, night. Quinn is now on his phone, on the shuttle bus, reinstating all of his social networking apps, scrolling past months of well-wishing and rainbow pictures and smiley faces and frowny faces back to before. Quinn. Aha. He lands on one of Annabeth's posts at the beginning of December, before she was killed. He's looking for clues. When were she and Jeff seeing each other? How did Quinn not know? How could the two closest people to him have been carrying on such a secret and secretive backstory without Quinn's knowledge? How? How could they not have told me? "Move up, dude," somebody says. I'm still in Station Square, in line for the shuttle back through the tunnel and to the T, so that we can all go back south. No, so that I can go to Jeff's house and bash his face in. I will figure out the theory of why my anger at him is white hot like a griddle sometime between Beachview and Keystone Oaks. "What the actual fuck is up with these fireworks?" I say to the guy behind me.
"They're shooting some movie."
And that is all he has to say. As if perched on stilts that have a brain of their own, my legs walk me away from the shuttle bus, which is expelling a black smog that coughs and hiccups like Carly back on the boat of secrets. My stilts are taking me to this temporary chain-link fence that I now realize isn't typically found in Station Square, which is a sort of upscale mall place. There are handsome, fit men all around who don't look as if they're from Pittsburgh, standing at a kind of gated entrance into a massive area where the Summer Jam Series offers concerts that Mom never lets me come downtown for. But there's no band playing tonight. Tonight, the temporary floodlights spill over and practically compete with the fireworks above, and I see a giant movie camera high in the sky and a woman looking into the monitor, and she yells, "Cut!" Not 12 seconds later, the fireworks stop and some background extras clap. I know what this is. "Hey, I'm with South Hills Apprentice," I blurt out to a guy with a clipboard and a walkie-talkie. He holds his finger up to me and says into a little mouthpiece, "Yeah, we're going back for one more take. Have Bryson go to makeup." And then he's with me, kind of. "What'd you say?" "I'm with South Hills Apprentice," I say, certain I am getting this right. This has to be it. I know it is. "And you are?" "Quinn Roberts. I'm with Ricky Devlin's entourage." Lies spill from my mouth as fully formed sitcom pilots. The camera behind the fence descends and the woman hops off. A PA hands her a bottle of water. This lady huddles up a crew next, and I am immediately as enamored of the shooting of South Hills Apprentice as I have been with any film ever. I want to be in this world. I want to get past this guy at the gate and go to craft services and eat free cheese and get lost. "You have a badge or what?" the guy says. "I forgot it in my trailer," I say. Rookie mistake. I wouldn't have a trailer if I weren't an actor. But one thing Ricky Devlin taught me, write dialogue fast, 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 because people don't think before they talk. Make it real. Make it true. But it didn't work so much this time. "Why don't you show me your ID then, and I can check the master list?" But I know there's no way I'm getting past this guy. A mosquito lands on his neck, and I don't tell him, and I see, behind the fence, the skinny star and the frustrated director having a little fight. Having words, my mom would say. The actress pulls from a discreet pocket in her skirt a piece of script, just one page, and they're arguing over dialogue. I know this, because Annabeth would call me when she was shooting our films to say, "So-and-so feels stupid saying this line," or, "The weather changed, and now it's ridiculous to refer to the sun. Can we just say the clouds?" And I would tweak and rewrite over the phone, and that is what is happening. I know it. I know this conversation. "So you kind of have to get lost," the guy says to me, because, update, I am now leeched onto the chain link, pressing my chin through it. At this moment, a new guy arrives onto the scene. Too muscular, with hair too long to make up for a bald spot that shines in the floodlight, as if he is lit from within and his lid has come off. "Ricky Devlin!" I yell, I really do, but he can't hear me. The extras are making so much noise that I want to shush them, but there isn't time because a strong hand is on my shoulder and peeling me from the fence, just as I'm watching Ricky Devlin get pulled into the director-star conversation. All three of them swarmed by the many bugs that populate a Midwestern summer night. "You're too young for me to call security on you," the guy says, "so let's not make a scene." He looks away from me and nods at someone and goes, "Go on through." And when I turn, I recognize the someone, but how? He's short, handsome, has a bartender vibe. He has a badge, too. And then, "Juan," I say. Ricky Devlin's boyfriend looks at me, startled. His lips are big, and I see immediately the appeal they'd have. "Do I know you? Tell Ricky Devlin that Quinny Roberts is here and is desperate to see him." The man with the hand is saying, "Security to gate 2, quietly into his radio thingy, but Juan puts his palm up and goes, "Quinn Roberts?" And I say, "Quinn Roberts." And Juan goes, "This kid's with me," to the man with the hand, who backs down and seems sad to have to let go of his small window of control. I am brought through the gates to Ricky Devlin. "Rick," Juan says, "you're not going to believe who I found." apparently I have been spoken of. But Ricky Devlin doesn't care who Juan found, because Ricky is squatting down with an old-fashioned pencil. He always wrote first drafts with a pencil, and rewriting something. He has moved out of the glare of the floodlight and knelt next to a drinks cooler, with a firefly hovering over his shoulder as if to light the page. "Rick," Juan says again, "it's your first fan." Ricky Devlin finally glances up and goes, "Not now, Juani." But Juan literally pushes me forward, and now Ricky Devlin looks at me, hard, like I'm a 10-minute timed essay that he doesn't know how to start. And I go, "It's me, Ricky Devlin." Perhaps nobody has Charlie Browned his name in a long time, because the script page falls from his lap and blows against the chain link fence, and the actress reaches for it and murmurs these newly written on the spot lines out loud to the director, and Ricky Devlin doesn't care. He is up now and gripping my triceps, if I had triceps, and looking as if he might weep. "These lines are perfect," the skinny star is saying behind him. "It's what I've been asking for all along, finally." That's when one stray firework goes off in the distance and nearly hits a passing airplane. But Ricky and I don't flinch. Chapter 28. We are in a makeshift tent, and I am eating so much free stuff you'd think it was my birthday dinner, which, it turns out, it is. You wouldn't believe the amount of free cheese and chips and even burritos and celery and stuff they've got on a real Hollywood film shoot, but they do. My God, they do. "I was extremely sorry to hear about Annabeth over Christmas," Ricky Devlin says. He is fiddling with one of the puka shell necklaces that hot California surfer boys wear. He is too old to be wearing it, but maybe not. "Yeah, it beyond sucks," I say. I am stuffing myself with carrots. My mouth isn't sure how to react to such subtle flavorings. "I probably have to get back on set soon," Ricky Devlin says. "Big night, 4th of July scene." He keeps trying not to look at something happening behind me. I'm picturing one of the people in a headset glaring at Ricky Devlin and pointing to a watch on her wrist as if to say, "Time is money in Hollywood, if not in Pittsburgh." In Pittsburgh, time is just endless. "But you're welcome to hang around tonight as my guest. I really hope you do." I push the plate away. There is so much to say and ask, and the truth is, I feel like I've arrived at Ricky Devlin as if he's the mentor in my own hero's journey, so that he'll give me the sword to go and find Jeff and kill him. But that would put me square at the beginning of the film. You always meet the mentor at the beginning, and God knows I have to start wrapping this up. "Ricky Devlin, I'm lost in my screenplay." "Whoa, I'm thrilled to hear you're still writing," he says. He holds up a pointer finger to the person behind me, as if to go, "One more minute with this charity case and I'll be right there." "No, I mean, the screenplay of my life." I realize how this sounds. I don't care, it's my fucking birthday. "There's a lot of shit that went down this week. I came out of hibernation. My mom started finding old money from my grandpa. I went to Kennywood." No. These aren't the important details. Jesus, Quinn, always cut the prologue. "I'm not totally following," Ricky Devlin says. His eyes don't twinkle anymore. They used to twinkle. "I met this really cute guy this week," I say. "Wow," Ricky goes. "Little Quinny Roberts, all grown up." Now he's twinkling. "God, what are you, like 18? And leaning in. "I can't believe you're this cute man now with, like, a butt." No. Weird. Ignore. "I'm 17 as of, like, 10 hours ago." Beat. Ricky leans back. Beat. I lean in. "So, anyway, I met this boy, and I really like him, but I also just found out something crazy about my sister and my best friend.
And I can't tell if this is the part where shit happens or where I go home beaten up but a little wiser.
Oh my God, Ricky goes. You remember my hero's journey screenwriting guide.
Remember it, I say.
I bounce my knee so hard underneath these makeshift tables that I whack into a metal bar and it stings.
I use it every day. It's my, like, life guide.
Quinn, I hate to break it to you. I hold up my finger now. Then don't. I stop bouncing my knee. I don't want anything else broken to me or on me.
There is a buzz of walkie-talkies all around us, and I realize we are being circled, that perhaps half the entire crew is upon us, trying to pull Ricky Devlin from my apparently Lolita-like grip.
Interesting film, skip the 97 remake, haven't read the book.
I see you people, Ricky Devlin says to them. Give me another minute.
The twinkle is gone again, replaced by two little pinpricks called tired eyes. He looks like an old picture of himself with a bad filter thrown on top that's giving him not an eternal tan, but rather a speckled crust.
Just help me with, like, one thing, I say to him. When you get stuck with a scene, do you always go back to the formula?
I reach for my phone. I want to take notes.
Somebody hands Ricky Devlin some big-ass earphones. You want the truth?
Of course, I say.
This is the fourth screenplay I sold.
Okay. I open up the notes app on my phone. That's awesome.
And it's the first one where I threw out all the rules and just wrote from, like, my heart. No rules. No three-act structure. I wrote it on spec in one weekend. My agents sold it the next Thursday. Fuck the inciting incident. Fuck the page count. Just write the truth.
I can't be hearing this.
This is awful news. Ricky Devlin's screenwriting basics are my Bible.
This is
a test, yes. This is classic. He is the imposter. He is donning a false mask. Do not trust this.
Quinny, he says, but I'm moaning a little bit. I really have to get back to set, which is sort of killing me, but like I said, you can...
It's my birthday, I say. I push away from the table and grab his arm. I am a madman.
That's right, Ricky Devlin says. He touches my hand. You made us celebrate your entire birthday week when I sat for you guys. So funny.
They're tearing down the Liberty, I say.
They're... Wait, what?
You sometimes don't remember something until you're standing in front of it. It was Ricky Devlin who introduced me to the Liberty. He cried at the Shawshank Redemption. I was embarrassed for him, and then I wasn't. I pull my hand out from beneath his.
Yeah, or they're renting it out, I say. It got shut down. The rich guy who financed the Liberty died.
Ricky Devlin rolls his eyes. Jesus, I leave this town and the whole thing goes to pot.
I'll say this. Ricky Devlin has amazing arms. They are huge, almost quad-like. He was skinny like me when he was closer to my age. Can I have his arms someday without also having the bald spot? He got to keep his sister, so can I keep my hair?
I loved the Liberty, Ricky Devlin says. He shakes his head in a way that's too over the top, like when your high school counselor pretends to care that your dad left your mom on her 40th birthday. A loud bell goes off, a school bell, almost. Ricky Devlin stands up and backs away. Let me sign something for you, for your birthday.
All this time, I had Ricky Devlin pegged as the god figure who would one day return as a majestic, helpful spirit with eternally thick hair and eyes that twinkle endlessly.
Here, he says.
He has torn off a corner of paper. He has signed it for me.
Stick around and stay on the fringes and keep in touch, Quinny.
Okay.
But I don't stick around. I watch Ricky Devlin take a glance back at me and bite his lip and then exit the tent back out to the floodlights. And I look around and steal a few handfuls of soy sauce packets, Mom's favorite condiment, and then open his note, which he folded in half like a celebrity clue. Happy birthday to Quinny Roberts, who grew up, Ricky's autograph says. From your old friend, R.D. He has gone Hollywood on me. He has written down his email address and dated the note at the top. And seeing my birthday like that, I realize the six-month anniversary of Annabeth's death is almost here. She and I never missed a half birthday. We grew up in a household that never skipped an opportunity for sweets. A neighbor would die, and Mom would take us out for Sundays to celebrate the life they had as if she even knew the names of their kids. As if Amir even knew the names of everyone on his own boat tonight. I fold up Ricky Devlin's note and slide it into my pocket and head for the exit, and I step right onto the next sputtering shuttle that's leaving for the T. And instead of reinstating all my social networking apps, I power down my new phone and close my eyes and save up my energy to confront a guy I don't even know anymore, who has somehow figured into this particular birthday being the biggest letdown since the 1977 Exorcist sequel. But mostly I'm thinking, Ricky Devlin isn't the golden guy of my past, or even my future. He isn't going to rescue me. I'm on my own here, and maybe I don't see everything after all. Chapter 29. The scale of my life is all warped. I've been in my room for so many months that I've begun to think that humans only need about 10 square feet of living space. Twin-size bed, a closet with a broken hinge, a mini-fridge. And so standing here on Jeff's lawn, the greenest lawn in all the land, I can't even imagine what you do with all that space inside. And that's saying something, because I don't even have to. I grew up in that house. They kept track of how tall I was growing with little pencil marks in the door frame of their perfect gleaming kitchen. His dad taught me how to drive. His sister used to dress me up in tutus. The incomplete full-length film that I was 85 pages into writing last fall would have starred a young boy who wore tutus and army boots and was a superhero in his own mind. An 8-year-old, ideally, would have played him, the last age you can be without being self-conscious. Oh, it's true. Once you hit 9, it's all downhill, because you start noticing things other than the comics and your own belly button, and that sadness of growing subtly older sets in right around when you turn 10. Which is why society has created such a big deal out of double digits. We make a huge-ass deal out of double digits because if we didn't, kids would just start walking into traffic. We trick them into thinking double digits is when the glory years hit. Incorrect. Take it from a double-digit virgin. Last September, Annabeth cast a red-headed kid down the block to play the tutu and boots-wearing superhero, whose character codename in the movie, by the way, is Double Digits, which is also the name of the movie. Our last one together. It was a dark comedy. The kid is part of a society where, when you turn double digits, you are sent into battle. It's like a younger Hunger Games, but doesn't take itself so seriously. God, that film could have used some authentic laughs, and not just the kind you get by putting old sitcom stars in funny wigs. Double Digits was my most ambitious effort, and I had the whole thing plotted out, or most of it. I used Ricky Devlin's guide, but I hadn't finished the last 15-ish pages of the script, and Annabeth and I fought over that all this past September and October. She said if I wasn't going to write that college character recommendation for Mrs. Wadsworth to sign, can you at least finish your screenplay? We nearly killed each other on every film, even the 5-minute jokey ones. I suppose it took an hour-long dark comedy for me to literally murder my sister. Jesus Christ, you look like a murderer standing there. Oh, I say, turning to find my potentially former best friend, who's idling next to me at the curb in front of his ginormous house. Why aren't you inside? He rolls his eyes. Sorry, Quinn, my character can't always be where you want him to be. He pulls into the drive and cuts the engine. Should we go in? How long were you guys lying to me? I say, staying put. I want this moment to play out right here on the lawn. You and me and Annabeth were a club of three, I say. That was all I had. It comes out stilted. Not even Pacino could pull this junk off. Jeff's eyes go wide. Yeah, Carly just texted me about what happened on the boat, he goes. I'm gonna kill her. Let's not do this out here. No, seriously, I say, working myself up, making a neighbor's dog growl. When were you going to tell me you were sneaking around with my dead sister? Well, she wasn't exactly dead at the time. I open Jeff's car door. Exterior, Jeff's perfect lawn, night. Quinn takes Jeff by the lapels and flings him onto the lawn. He straddles Jeff and digs his knee right between Jeff's ribs. Quinn, seriously, explain yourself so that I don't freak out. Jeff, we didn't want to tell you. We were afraid you would overreact, like, you know, right now. I reach for Jeff's lapels, but what kind of kid wears lapels? He's in a t-shirt. His seatbelt is still on, and I don't fling him onto the lawn. I simply grab some fabric, and goddammit, we both start laughing. This isn't funny, I say. I say it again. This isn't funny, to convince myself. Then I collapse onto the grass and bring my heel down into it, 1, 2, 3, until I hit dirt. And Jeff goes, at least leave my lawn alone. That thing is my mom's pride and joy. And when I look up at him, one tear accidentally falls from my eye like Demi Moore in Ghost. Massively underrated performance/film. And Jeff goes, come on, birthday boy, let's go inside. So we do. We head to his basement, which is finished within an inch of its life. The whole thing feels like a showroom. You have to take off your shoes and everything. When were you going to tell me? I say again. Jeff sits on a sofa that is equally beautiful and uncomfortable. We didn't, like, know how to. Seriously, it was like friggin' Romeo and Juliet, the way we had to sneak around. Oh my God, the fact that you're even referring to the two of you as a we? I pick up a fake metal apple from a ceramic bowl. Dude, we knew you'd freak out. We just, like, instinctively knew you wouldn't support us. That you'd be this, like, weird kind of jealous. I go to say, that's so not fair, but he keeps barreling on. You were so tired of Annabeth getting everything handed to her first in life that we were like, if he finds out we're in a relationship before he even comes out of the closet himself? I almost throw the apple at his mom's wall. I wouldn't have been jealous, I say. I would have appreciated you being honest with me. Jeff's lips sputter. You're so full of shit, Q. Give me one example of how I have been anything less than a best friend. Sometimes it feels like all you care about is your screenplays. Or cared. He is hugging a sofa cushion, and when I unblur my eyes, I realize he is actually using it for protection. Yeah, well, I don't think I'm ever getting back to my screenplay. I don't have a reason to. That's actually, Jeff says, this is an awkward segue, but that's why I wanted you to come over tonight. He puts the pillow aside slowly, as if setting down a weapon outside a hostage situation. A package showed up at my house this week. Like, for you. I've been trying to find a way to... Just hold on. Jeff disappears for a moment into a storage room in their basement, one of four in their house. This house practically has more storage rooms than my house does rooms, period. I walk over to Jeff's family's treadmill and I look up at this stone fireplace thing they've got, and my eyes rest on the mantle, where an expensive-looking Chinese vase sits shiny and still. The vase looks so familiar, and when I realize why, it wallops me hard like some sports metaphor involving a stray ball that I won't even attempt. I'll be right back, Jeff calls. Stay there! Annabeth's ashes sit in a vase just like this in our sunroom. It was a gift from Jeff's mom to my mom. Literally, it's the same exact face with the same exact vaguely oriental pattern, but in a different color. Probably bought on the same day at the same store. Jeff's mom said she knew Annabeth's favorite color was orange, an odd color for an odd girl, and that she wanted us to have it in case we decided to keep Annabeth's ashes on display. She had brought it to the memorial, I was told. I was not at the memorial. I had promised my mom I'd say some remarks that day, but like everything in my life, I put it off until the very last moment. Another promise that became another lie. So instead of ad-libbing and making a blubbering fool of myself in front of all the first tiers at school, I was on the floor of my bathroom wearing earplugs, with my forehead pressed against the coolness of my toilet. Okay, Jeff says, entering the room again just as the rage bubbles up in me like when you add Mentos to Coke and it explodes like a geyser. It comes to me, that is, why I am the kind of mad known as sad. There's so much about Annabeth's life that will never be. She will never share an Oscar with me. She will never have her kids call me Uncle Wynn. She will never have kids. And I was kind of getting used to that concept. But now this, too? This idea that there are things about Annabeth that actually happened that I'll never know, that she and Jeff were sneaking around behind my back, merely points out the grimmest truth of all. That there are hours and days and months from her life, an autobiography she'll never get to share with me. She didn't keep a diary that I know of. She called our films her diary, but I think she did it just to humor me. Quinn? Something about Annabeth having this secret with my best and only friend underlines how now she's being relegated to sitting there in an urn in the sunroom, forever not able to answer my questions. Why are you being so snippy with me at the coffee shop? I say to Jeff. I can't look at him. I am typing 666 into the treadmill just to have the distraction of a beep. It was our anniversary, he says. What? When you came to Loco Mocha yesterday, it was my anniversary with Annabeth. It would have been a year. I was really upset that I couldn't share that, like, heaviness with you. Wait, you were seriously officially dating? Yeah, when we could sneak in time behind your back, which actually wasn't that hard. You never notice anything if it's not about you. I step off the treadmill and back Jeff into the sofa. We were in love with each other, he says. I am holding so many feelings inside that my body is the second Civil War. Just stop talking for a second, okay? Jeff's eyes spill over. I lost her too, you know. You don't own the trademark on mourning your sister. I reach to touch him, and a breeze sweeps through the basement. Annabeth's ghost, I'm thinking, but it's not. It's the vortex created by the door at the top of his stairs opening. And I hear his mom's voice. Jeff, everything okay down there? And God love the kid, he goes, no. And he is crying and not trying to hide the brokenness from his mom. It's not. And she scurries down the stairs and comes to the French doors leading to the basement. She is in a silk robe. Her hair is up, and although she is thin, my mom is prettier. Quinn, she says. I turn away and put the metal apple down, afraid I might launch it at any moment. I told him, Jeff says, but I don't think he believes me. No, I do, I'm saying, but then he says, tell him, Mom, tell him how in love with Annabeth I was. I can't handle this. Hell, I could barely handle that Annabeth never got to have a boyfriend, but now this, that Annabeth was in love with somebody and then had that taken away from her, it's too tragic. I just can't. This is so not like you guys to keep something from me. This is exactly why we didn't tell you, Jeff says. He gets up from the sofa. Boys, his mom says. She used to say the same thing when we were in sixth grade and we would tell sex jokes in the backseat of yet another brand new Toyota. Sex jokes that we thought his mom wouldn't get. The whole world isn't yours to decide, Quinn, Jeff says. And when he's jabbing his finger into my chest, that's when I notice the strange manila envelope in his other hand, the thing he retrieved from storage. "Boys," his mom says again, "come on, let's cool down and meet up again tomorrow." "Mom, get out of here. It's fine," Jeff says, but it isn't, and he's scaring me. Jeff is the optimist. Jeff isn't the one to jab or get violent. His parents had a no-hitting rule. Mine didn't. "Were you ever going to tell me?" I say. From overhead, we must look like a pretty good setup to a pretty dynamic scene. The aging architect in the robe, the weird kid in the fake glasses, the best friend with the mystery envelope. It's not a bad scenario if only I knew the ending. "No," Jeff says, "because when Annabeth went to college, we were going to break up." He falls back into the couch and puts his head in his hands and plainly sobs. And as he sobs, goobs of snot and spittle fall from his face like falling water, the field trip all Pennsylvanian children are required to take at least twice. And when the goobs fall forth, they land on the manila envelope by his feet with a return address from Los Angeles with the word "congrats" printed across the front and with my name, Quinn Roberts, written above Jeff's address. The word "urgent" stamped in red ink. "What the hell is that?" I say. "Language," Jeff's mom says, and the three of us somehow laugh, as if hell is the worst thing I've ever said or the worst concept I've ever imagined. Hell is your big sister losing her virginity to your best friend and neither one of them being confident enough to share that news with you because you are, in fact, the monster of this picture. Godzilla got to be the title role, but my God, he was still the monster, still the antagonist, still the wickedest. That is me, the creature who destroys villages and has to be tiptoed around. "Open it," Jeff says. "Happy fucking birthday." He looks up like a little boy might. His mom wants to say "language" again, but she doesn't. I reach for the envelope. My hands are shuddering. I am hungry, or perhaps horny. I have never wondered what Jeff would look like naked, but now, suddenly, knowing that he has had sex makes me feel as if I'm meeting a celebrity. "Why?" I ask when I open the envelope and my eyes scan the letter. I don't even know what I mean, but that is the word. "Why?" I say again as I read the one-pager from the Los Angeles Society of Young Filmmakers. "Dear Mr. Roberts," it says, as if I'm my dad, "thank you for applying to the Los Angeles Society of Young Filmmakers Summer Lab." "I didn't apply to this lab," I say. "I never finished the what the hell is this?" "Keep reading," Jeff says. His cheeks are stained a translucent white, either zip medication running from the tears or maybe just sunblock. No. Definitely sunblock. Jeff doesn't need zit medication. "I'm going to get you boys a snack," Jeff's mom says, taking off. Leave it to a mom to solve any problem with a snack, and yet, they are always right about this. "We are writing to inform you that your screenplay, Double Digits, has been chosen as a finalist for the Screenwriters Division of the LASYF for this August. As you no doubt know, only 5 screenwriters and 5 directors are chosen each summer, out of submissions that number in the thousands. You were number 1 on the waitlist, and due to a technical eligibility requirement not being met by a previous finalist, we are delighted to accept you into our upcoming lab. Please note the urgent nature of the following. If you wish to attend, we will need to hear from you by August 1st for an August 18th start in Los Angeles. We are unable to supply housing or airfare. Most vitally, we cannot accept incomplete screenplays. You must supply the final pages to us by August 1st, the same date as the official opt-out, or we will have to ask you to reapply again in the future. Please reply at your earliest convenience, and congratulations again on the thrilling first draft of Double Digits. We look forward to pairing you with a student director in Los Angeles. Sincerely, Gloria Katz, Chair, the LASYF. Jeff's mom reappears in the doorway with a tray. This breaks my heart. My poor mom would never think to serve something on a tray. The snack would never even make it out of the kitchen. I don't understand anything anymore, I say to Jeff. Annabeth and I didn't apply to this. I don't understand this. Nobody has read that script except my sister, who found it limited and said it wasn't my best work of all time and was going to be impossible to direct, that it could use professional guidance, that she wished Ricky Devlin were still around to mentor me. Or we could just apply to this, she wrote when she forwarded me the link to the lab in L.A. I printed out the application that night, feeling smug for such an accomplishment, as if the damn thing would just fill out its own pages. Annabeth and I applied for you, Jeff says. Beat, beat, beat. What the fuck are you talking about? I say, but I am so quiet that I scare myself. Jeff's mom's lips mouth the word language, but they don't say it. If your script wins at the end of the lab, Jeff says, taking a baked pita chip from the tray, double digits will get screened on some festival circuit. I bounce a little, as if prepping to spring away to the moon, or even better, directly into the sun. What are you... That is the, like, working title. That isn't even... Nobody was supposed to see that, except her. I specifically didn't apply because the screenplay wasn't ready. I know, Jeff says, droll. But Annabeth and I were tired of seeing you being so precious about every last little thing. Sweetie, his mom says, and he snaps at her. Give us some space, Mom. Never mind, he doesn't snap. I forgot that in some families, the men are able to ask for what they want without violence edging their voices like burnt paper. I'll be right upstairs, his mom says. She is forever working on her architecture plans, forever constructing buildings to behave just the way she wants them to. I get this completely. It's a huge opportunity, dude, Jeff says, as if he's Mrs. Friggin' Kelly in the cinder block counselor's room. Then why are you crying, I say, and he really is, his face running like falling water again, an unlimited brook of tears. Thousands of applicants, screenwriters and filmmakers, and you got in. We were on the wait list, I say, folding the paper in half. You got in. Then why, I say again, are you crying? We sent in the first three quarters of your screenplay, which wasn't even allowed. It had to be a complete script. Yes, I know. That's why I didn't apply. But you got in because you're that fucking good. I unfold the page and look at it again. We are writing to inform you your screenplay Double Digits has been chosen as a finalist for the... And I see that only the screenwriter's box is checked, that the director's box is empty. But the thing is, Jeff goes, Annabeth didn't want... But the way he says makes me know this is not just an There's always an and with Jeff. What? I say, what didn't she want? Annabeth didn't want to check off the director's box, Jeff says, a thin film of saliva breaking across his mouth, like the giant bubbles we used to play with back in the summers when everything was possible. It would have been the easiest thing to do, to send in her reel and see if she'd get in too, but she was cool just letting this be your thing, Quinny. No, that doesn't even sound like her. She always said your dialogue is what made the movies pop, Jeff says. And strangely, right at the climax of the scene, right when John Williams would bring in the saddest, lowest horns to make you cry, Jeff doesn't keep crying. The tears stop and he offers a wounded smile like a truce. And she was obviously right. I look at his mom's vase. So, wait, now you actually expect me to go to, like, Los Angeles and get paired with some anonymous person who isn't your dead girlfriend? This is how you want me to celebrate my birthday? Never mind, he's crying again. Jeff's Adam's apple jumps up and down like the trampoline in our neighbor's yard. He can't speak. Mm-hmm, he finally manages to hum. I am all out of dialogue. I walk very slowly to the tray of food, and I pick up the whole thing and almost throw it against his perfect wallpapered wall. It would make for such a strong, complicated goodbye. But I am not going to be that guy. So all I do is set down the tray and tear the paper in half and crumple it up and throw it at Jeff. She didn't want this dream, Quinn, he says, finally, when I'm putting the bowling shoes on again with my back to him. But you do. Or did. I push through the French doors. I don't even stop when Jeff's mom tries to hug me by their kitchen island. By the time I'm 10 minutes out of the good part of town, I get this somewhat fucked up idea for how to turn my birthday around, how to even the score with my best friend, with the universe, how to play catch-up with my sister. What was that you said? I text Amir just as I'm getting to my neighborhood. About getting me laid tonight? Chapter 30. One shower later, I'm sitting outside on our crumbly front steps, picking at a scab on my knee that I didn't even know had been scabbed. What I'm not doing is I'm not walking up the street and waiting for Amir to pick me up there. I'm just letting him show up outside our house in plain sight. I suppose I'm coming out in 12 easy steps. It is 10:59 p.m. when I see his dirty Saturn peep up from the top of our hill. No fair, he goes when he pulls up and I step in. You got to clean up after my party. I have some CK1 upstairs. You want me to run in and get you some? But he doesn't, and I don't. And what we do is we drive back to the bowling lanes so I can get my old Vans and give them back their bowling shoes and start to reset the world back to its old ways. Hey, he says, buckle up, just as we're speeding past the high school. Something about watching Amir drive stick shift is maybe the hottest thing ever. Did I already say that? He is just so forceful with it. So, he says, now we're sitting in the parking lot of the bowling alley. It's late, officially very much not my birthday. Officially next year. I was kind of surprised to hear from you tonight. I mean, after. Yeah, well, I say, I felt kind of embarrassed about running away from your boat and I wanted to apologize. Lie, I want to get laid. I'm really sorry that Carly broke the news about Jeff and your sister, Amir goes. It was seriously uncool of her. For the record, I had no idea. Carly lives on gossip. It's just Carly being Carly. A bird spins itself in nervous circles right above Amir's windshield. It must be lost. It's too late for a bird to be away from its tree. Should we go back to my place? He's already turning the car back on. And my heart starts to go faster than I want it to. I don't like not being in control, and it feels as if a riverboat is in my chest, churning against my stomach. Sure thing, I say, practically like I mean it. It takes a 3-floor trek upstairs to an apartment covered in boxes for it to actually hit me that Amir really is going. He is not out of breath, but I am. Okay, hang out on the couch, he goes, and flip the AC on, for the love of God. I'm hopping in the shower. I look up to see this perfect shirtless boy, his boxers puffed out the top of his shorts like a muffin, a small scar on his stomach existing only to show in stark contrast how flawless the rest of him is. When he's gone, I take my own shirt off and hold my phone out far and look at myself in the reverse camera and oh my God, I hope he likes truly skinny guys. The shower cheep-cheeps off. I put my shirt back on. I debate about running for it. Should I put some music on? He calls out, and I go, mm-hmm, okay. And he returns in mesh shorts and a tank top and this Texas ball cap that makes me want to eat him. It's so cute. Mesh shorts on guys are my weakness, by the way. Mesh shorts are the coming attractions of the hot boy clothing world. He sits on the sofa and hands me his laptop and goes, you have to pick what you want to listen to. So I take Amir's laptop, and though I guess I'm supposed to be picking out makeout music, instead I multitask and say, Morning pages. What's morning pages? Looking at the only file on his desktop. Amir reaches across and takes the laptop out of my lap faster than you can say calm down. Nothing, he goes. Well, it's something, I go, and he rolls his eyes and goes, it's kind of like a journal. I wake up every day and write 3 tangential pages back to back. I smile my best sly smile. I've practiced it in the mirror for years. Okay, I say, and yet you're going to school for business and not writing? He lies back on the couch and digs his feet underneath my butt, and it is very sweet. You should read me some of these morning pages, I say, and he laughs and goes, oh, I so should not do that. I reach my arm back to lay it across the couch, and my elbow grazes a picture frame, which tips over and lands with a solid clack. I worry that maybe I've cracked the glass, but when I set it up again, it is not broken. It is a perfect, unharmed photo of 2 guys. Amir, next to somebody dad age. Who's that? I say, and the way Amir goes, oh, that's Evan. I know it's over. How long were you together? I'm not doing the flirty mouth thing anymore. Well, that's presumptuous, Amir says. He wiggles his toes and it tickles my butt. I squirm, but I don't laugh. This night has no clear ending. It's all middle. I pick up the photo and launch an investigation. Clue number 1, Evan is holding Amir's waist. 1.5 years, Amir says, finally, and then, until he fucking cheated on me with one of his students. The AC clicks off. Where is he now? Back in Texas, he says, and I go, back in Texas. Because I like when dialogue echoes, except not this time. I am in a brain fog when Amir opens his laptop back up and turns on some music that sounds familiar, something rousing and orchestral and more cinematic somehow than straightforward trumpets usually are. And I know it, I know it, I know it. And finally I go, wait, don't tell me. And Amir smiles and goes, I wasn't going to. He gets up close to my face and kisses my forehead. Chug, chug, chug. The riverboat is back in my chest. Read something to me, I say, because suddenly I'm back to being unsure if I'm ready to have sex. What do you mean? He goes. Read me some of your work out loud. Only if you do, he goes, and he plops back onto the sofa. No way, I go. My stuff is junk and I don't have any of it on me. You don't back it up in the cloud? Well, yeah, but... He puts his laptop on my lap. Spotify is minimized. The trumpets continue to blat and cry. I'll read you the first page of my terrible novel if you read me the first page of your terrible screenplay. No, I go, but I'll pull up some Vimeos of my old films with Annabeth and leave the room for 15 minutes and you can watch whatever you want. Films are meant to be seen, not read. Thanks, Mom. He goes, and that is getting old faster than hot milk. He takes the laptop back from me. I've already watched all your films, he goes, just like that. And I go, wait, what? And he goes, after that celebrity game night thing, I was all, who is that guy? And Carly was all, you have to see his movies. I stare at a crack across the blank wall of his apartment and expect it to open up and swallow me into a portal. Those weren't my movies. Those were our movies. Change the scene, switch the topic, take control of the narrative. It comes to me. Elmer Bernstein, I say. It's just Elmer Bernstein has a very distinctive cinematic underscoring style, and his music is drowning out this conversation on Amir's couch. Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. Correct, Amir smiles. You are good. He double-clicks and then double-clicks again, and then, I've never done this. Read my work out loud. Oh, this is kind of fun. I can be the loyal guy Evan never was. This will convince Amir to stay here. I will move in with him next year. I will work at Carnegie Library and watch DVDs all day. We will have brown babies because we will use his DNA. I'm waiting. I say, pointing to the computer. He turns the volume down on Elmer Bernstein and clears his throat, and he puts his feet on my lap, and they smell just faintly, faintly, faintly like boy feet, and something about that is very wonderful. Maybe I do want to have sex. It seems like I only want to have sex when I'm not thinking about it, and I only don't want to have sex when I am. Okay, so, Amir goes, and I go, stalling! And he goes, no, wait. And his eyes are scanning page one, just like mine always did right before I would read my first drafts for Annabeth. And he goes, oh, I'm not sure about this. And I go, come on, isn't this the novel that got you into this prestigious program? And when I say it out loud, I'm thinking about what it would be like for me to go to LA and be paired with some anonymous new director, and that's just one big fat no, right there. The Wachowskis, the Efron sisters, the Nolans. Q&A. I have been alive for 17 years. How is some brand new director going to be able to decode all the nuances and jokes and not jokes in my work? So, okay, Amir says. He takes his feet off my lap and turns around so that his back is totally facing me.